it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome back to the Shamrock, brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best live and on demand. Learn more at DirecTV.com. I am Pete Sampson, joined as always by my co-host Matt Fortuna. And today's special guest, I think one of our most popular guests based on the two or three comments that we receive on our podcast, John Walters, Notre Dame alum, author of The Bubble Screen, my favorite sort of wrap-up. A sort of pithy commentary on TV. So I guess, John, welcome back to the show. You're here to entertain us, so hopefully this will be a funny next 45 minutes.
Well, Pete, I got the request to appear on the Shamrock, and I looked at the schedule. I said, obviously, this must be Notre Dame's biggest football game of the season. That is why Matt and Pete are coming to me. So I am here for you on this game that everyone's had circled on their calendars for at least a year.
For the record, I mean, full disclosure, we hopefully you're not put off by this. We were trying to get Greg McElroy, and he sort of blew us off. So
I'm the Regis Philbin Tony Randall of the Shamrock. That's fine. I don't mind.
Can we get a bubble screen preview right now of your thoughts on Notre Dame's home opener being behind a paywall streaming?
I mean, I hope you guys are tweeting really well, because I'm going with what Mark Packer, who's my new ESPNU radio favorite guy, said. He's like, I'm going to be calling people. I'm not specifically subscribing to Shamrock for this game.
Or Peacock.
This is a Shamrock. You better subscribe.
To the Peacock. Peacock, Shamrock, you guys. Yes, I'm not subscribing to Peacock for this game unless, you know, the higher ups at The Athletic all of a sudden, you know, put it in the expense report. But you guys, again, you need to be on your tweeting game on Saturday. Otherwise, I'm not going to know what's going on.
It's a lot of pressure. I think this is going to be a heavy tweet game. John, you are a media critic. And so I wanted to start with the most ridiculous thing that I saw and heard last weekend from Notre Dame's opener at Florida State. Also, you have a good historical perspective, so you know who John McKay is.
Yes.
What is wrong with us that Brian Kelly making a poorly delivered joke that he had to explain became a headline? Like, what is wrong with us as a society?
Well, a lot, obviously. But let's – I know Matt is going to Matt's going to know exactly where I'm going here. You probably will, too. This reminds me of the Seinfeld episode with Dr. Timothy Watley, Watney.
I'm offended as a comedian. That's what I was thinking of.
Yes.
That's exactly what I was thinking of when he said it.
No, I'm offended as a comedian.
Yeah.
It's not that he didn't deliver the joke well.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Well, plus, you know, so many folks now don't even know the reference. But the original joke by John McKay was a question. What do you think of your team's execution? And he said, I'm in favor of it. So it's pithy, it's snappy. Brian Kelly, in the moment, over-explained the joke.
And it's rule number one of jokes, don't do that.
Right, you don't want to do that. And so I thought, it was funny because I wrestled on whether or not to put it into the bubble screen this week, and I did not. And one of the reasons I didn't, I thought, I'm going to be accused of mansplaining Brian Kelly's joke if I do this. But I just think, like you, it's get over it. Get over it. That's, to me, like the three greatest words of advice for most younger people today is just get over it. And so it wasn't a big deal. Personally, here's my theory on this. I think Brian Kelly really wanted to say how furious he was at the referees. And he knew that was not something he should say on national TV. So he was sort of caught on a, like, what am I supposed to talk about here? But if you look at it, think of like the two referee moments in the fourth quarter or overtime of that game that are just, they're inexplicable, and they're there's no way to, you know, what's the word I'm looking for here? Just to, I don't want to say forgive it. The roughing the punter and the fumble incomplete pass are Tuck rule level. We're never going to see those penalties called that way again. Not one, but two. And if you're Brian Kelly, aren't you just like, how do you, you're apoplectic at that moment.
Yeah, and he was post-game. I believe our friend Tim Priester started into a question about officiating, and like whoever was going to ask that question was going to get the, of course you would ask about that. What do you even want me to say? Like, it was, yeah. There was a lot to process in that game anyway, mm-hmm. like without the calls. Yes. So I sort of get why he was like, when he came into his post-game presser, like, that dude was fried. Like, he had had a long, long night. And I think that it was – the officiating was only a part of that. But I just don't think he was thinking clearly when Katie George went up to him to ask for, like, hey, what did you think of what the heck happened tonight? No.
He clearly wasn't. And, you know, there's so much, like you said, there was a lot to unpack. I teach a class at ASU, and we went over the fourth quarter about how you would cover that game. But one of the things that amused me was that Houston Griffith getting beat on the long pass was actually his second worst defensive play of the game.
Yeah, the first being knocking off Jordan Travis's helmet, forcing him out of the game.
Don't do that. Don't unleash the moment. And I mean, let's face it, the moment – Mackenzie Milton completed that first pass, it went through everybody's head, right?
Yes.
The first completion, you're like, uh-oh, I know where this is going. I know where this is going. I'm slightly surprised that Notre Dame won the game, and I think that's their first overtime road win.
It is.
They've ever had, right?
It is.
Wow.
So, crazy. That,
you know, it reminded me of Mo Lewis. Like, Mo Lewis birthed Tom Brady by hitting Drew Bledsoe out of bounds and changing the trajectory of
the, really, franchise.
The sport of football.
Yeah, the sport of football.
But Brian Kelly there reminded me almost of like my dad or a drunk uncle, like getting up at the Thanksgiving dinner table. And it's just like, don't do it, don't do it. Now you're explaining it. Everyone's looking at each other awkwardly.
And then if you try to explain the bad joke, it's only worse for you. So just stop talking.
Well, I will say we're 4 days out from this game. My mentions are still a tire fire of people arguing with each other whether he actually meant to kill his players or not. So we're in a good place as a fan base and a podcast right now, if that's what we're talking about.
Well, it's better than he should be fired because they lost, right? So
yes.
There's that part of it as well. The weird part about that game, and maybe we can talk about it real quick, is after about 10 minutes, you thought, oh my gosh, maybe Notre Dame's underrated at number 8 or 9 or whatever they're at. After about... until the 90-yard run or 89-yard run, they looked really, really good. You know, opening series, touchdown, defense smothering Florida State. And then all of a sudden the game changed into a game. But for about 8 minutes there, I'm sure ND Nation was just thinking, like, are we going to be second or third in the playoff selection, you know?
Yeah, it was fun to watch from that perspective because it was – you saw some evolution from, you know, Tommy Reese offensively. Certainly the defense was completely different from Marcus Freeman to Clark Lee, and it all sort of like unraveled there in the fourth quarter. But I think I want to get your perspective on this because, I mean, you've covered Brian Kelly games. Obviously, you know Notre Dame, like what it's about. We're sitting here. Brian Kelly is 2 wins away from tying Newt Rockne for the all-time wins record. And I still feel like he is underappreciated nationally, and certainly I think even underappreciated from Notre Dame's own fan base. Like, how do you process that part of it? The fact that we're covering a coach here that is about to tie and eventually surpass the statue, the guy who is Notre Dame football.
I don't think Brian Kelly is lovable. And I think he's an incredibly, incredibly intelligent and precise coach. He is a CEO. And one thing that I've talked about, and you guys I'm sure have written about, is ever since 2016, which is 17, 18, this is the fifth season now, Notre Dame does not lose a game that it's supposed to win. And that's highly underappreciated by most fan bases outside. I mean, you know, Tuscaloosa and maybe one other town. Okay, but every place else, it happens. Ask Oklahoma fans about losing a game you're supposed to win or being up 20 points and then choking in the fourth quarter at home. Notre Dame does not lose those games because they're an extremely well-coached team, and that's complete credit to Brian Kelly. But he doesn't have Lou Holtz's gift for charm, Ara Persijan's sense of being all about Notre Dame, Newt Rockne's everything. And these are the people he is going to be compared against, fairly or unfairly. Even Terry Brennan, who just passed away, and you guys know that. I mean, he went down to Oklahoma and ended the longest winning streak in college football history. Even though he wasn't a very successful Notre Dame coach, he will always live in the school lore for having done that. So the question comes back to, yes, Brian Kelly is going to beat Newt Rockne's all-time record, but Frank Leahy won a national championship, and Lou Holtz won a national championship, and Newt Rockne won a national championship. Did Brian Kelly win a national championship? And we'll say, well, the atmosphere is different. The environment is different these days, and it is. But this is the standard that people are going to hold him to, fairly or unfairly.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Our friend Ralph Russo and I have had this discussion where it just feels like in some ways he's always been a man without a home, for lack of a better analogy. I mean, I think part of that is he's basically been his own boss forever. So he doesn't have this like coaching tree or coaching friends or fraternity like so many other people in that business do. I think subconsciously, whether everyone will come out and say this or not, there's a piece in the back of the minds of every Notre Dame fan that will never forgive him for interviewing with the Eagles 2 days after the national championship game. Like, that's just not something, whether, and we don't know whether what was happening behind the scenes during the Holtz days and everything else, but it's just not something that I think a quote-unquote Notre Dame man or a guy who's happy to be Notre Dame would theoretically do in that moment. But he's also, and again, we've talked about this before, to his credit, he's not warm and cuddly, and he's never tried to be, and he's never cared.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, partly why some of his jokes fall flat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also why, like, it's helped him succeed in this environment in 2021 where you can't say anything without getting raked over the coals. There's an admirable quality to him that I don't think all of us appreciate in the moment, that we will definitely appreciate when it's gone, because it's so easy, especially at this level, at this job, to stub your toe every single day. And whether it's by just staying out of the spotlight or whatever it is, he's managed to be as private of a public figure as I can possibly imagine in that seat.
Yeah. And I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's, I know I'm not sticking to sports here, but you know, when the electricity always works and you turn on the faucet and the water always works, you don't appreciate all the work that goes into that. But then when you live someplace where all of a sudden the electricity doesn't work for a week, you're like, oh, you know what? It takes competence to have this stuff running. And everything you said, Matt, I agree with. Like, he's incredibly competent. It's very tough to stay at that school for 12 years or so and win consistently, which he has done, and not make everything dramatic. And Pete, you had that point after the game where you said, let's play if Lane Kiffin or Ed Orgeron had said the execution joke. It would have just been laughed off in 5 minutes. And we, you know, Ed Orgeron had a great line with the, you know, your sissy blue t-shirts.
Right.
And why should anybody be against these things? This is what makes college football wonderful.
You're dead on about that. I like to play the imagine if somebody else said things, or imagine if Brian Kelly said what Ed Orgeron said. Like, if Brian Kelly, if Notre Dame played UCLA and Brian Kelly made a sissy blue, like, that would be a huge story.
Right.
Or if Brian Kelly said, I'm just going to get COVID and keep it the rest of the year. We're playing so well. Like, people would lose it.
Yes, people would lose it.
So it's just, I mean, it's one of those Notre Dame things. Like, and it, like, Notre Dame should not complain about this treatment because it shows that people care all the time, mm-hmm. maybe too much. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a good thing. But it is bizarre to me, like, just like what weird college football coaches can say, and people just laugh it off. And then Brian Kelly will say something similar, and it's a, you have Chris Fowler tweeting about it, and it's in every media column or reaction to the weekend.
Well, allow me to make a reference almost as old as John McKay's, but, you know, Spicoli can say whatever he wants in class, but if Mark Radner does, you're like, you can't say that. You're the nerd, right? Like, you know, there's different characters who get away with different things. And Spicoli can, he's Spicoli. That's what makes, you know, he, and it's genuine. And you know, the genuine, authentic part of Brian Kelly is that he's incredibly professional in how he takes care of business. So he's not allowed to be Spicoli because that's not his personality. That's not what you guys see day in and day out. Ed Orgeron isn't that guy. Like, he's more of a caricature. So he can get away with it because it's all part of all the authenticity of Ed Orgeron. So, you know, that's part of it. Like, once Brian Kelly has been around so long, like Nick Saban, we know who he is, right? So we know who Nick Saban is. We know who Brian Kelly is. And when they go out of what we think of them as being, it ruffles feathers. And again, everything you said about Notre Dame, like, they just set themselves apart. They're not in a conference, blah, blah, blah. I sort of laughed the other night because I thought, wow, if Notre Dame was full-time ACC members this year, maybe they get one of those two calls at the end of the game. But it's almost like the ACC saying, it's not, there's nothing in it for us anymore. Like, we're human. Like, there's just nothing in it any for us to help you out. So sorry, that's not a 15-yard roughing the punter penalty, even though he spun around like a top. Too bad.
I would argue, like, we know who Brian Kelly is because we've covered him closely for 12 years. I still don't think the general public, and judging from the reaction to Sunday night, I would agree. I still don't think the general public has a clue about him other than the guy who occasionally gets purple-faced on the sidelines and yells at players. Like, I just don't think, and again, to his credit, he does not care, which mm-hmm. 119 out of 120 guys in that seat do care. He does not care what people think of him. But I think the lack of outreach in that regard hurts him in moments like that, like, as far as public perception. I mean, you know, Pete, and you like to play the what if game. Like, I just, it's Notre Dame. Like, Dabo says stupid stuff every day. Like, that's who he is. But he talks every day, so everyone forgets about it. Brian Kelly does not talk all that much relative to people in that seat. And I think that creates a, that lets stories or lets comments linger maybe longer than they should. One more thing, not to belabor the point, but I think John will appreciate this. You're a fan of Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post. He had a recent column talking about how no one feels bad for the Yankees. And he had two quotes in there that I immediately thought of Notre Dame when I read them. It was Joe Torre in 2001 saying, people love us, hate us, despise us, devote themselves to us. But one thing nobody is ever going to feel is sorry for us, no matter how bad things get for us. And that's 100% fair. And Joe Girardi added during an injury-ravaged season, I like to think people don't root for our guys to get hurt, but I absolutely understand that it doesn't break their hearts when stuff happens to us. And I think if there's a shortcoming at Notre Dame, it's their failure to recognize how important and how popular they are to so many people. I think too often they want the kid glove treatment when the reality is that's just not the case.
I accentuate your point, and Matt knows the bar. I was in Blondie's once on West 79th Street. It was the early 2000s, Matt. And Notre Dame,
I might have been there.
You might have been there. I know it wasn't you, but it might have been Darren Revelle, and you'll see where I'm going here.
Easy to get us too confused, but go on.
Okay. All right. Well, so Notre Dame is playing at Texas A&M. Early season game. Pete, I can't remember what year, you might remember it.
It's 2001.
They're getting destroyed. They're getting destroyed in College Station. And a fan in a Northwestern t-shirt stares at the screen and yells in jubilation, F you, Notre Dame. And I thought, where else does a guy who doesn't even go to Texas A&M, I mean, in a Northwestern shirt, get so happy that Notre Dame, like what other school would bring that sort of, you know, elation to someone that they would yell that in public because Notre Dame, like they're a school that they don't even isn't, they're not involved with is losing to, not to their team. That's to me, that's Notre Dame football right there.
Yeah. That's it. Party of one for Notre Dame. And that group.
It could have been Stuart Mandel. I'm not sure. I can't really recognize.
Yeah.
You know,
Brian Hamilton, maybe a little bit.
It could have been Brian. Well, Brian Hamilton was saying that in the press.
It could have been every single colleague of ours other than us three, because we're the only ones that didn't go to Northwestern.
All right, John, before we started recording, and I want to talk to you about Jack Cohn anyway, because I think it's kind of an interesting story. Is a one-off at Notre Dame sort of cuts against this, like, growing into the program vibe here. You know, there's the Wisconsin narrative coming up at the end of the month, but also the lacrosse part of it too. So you have to tell the story about what happened when you tweeted out something to that effect on Sunday night.
So I think Jack Cohn had just thrown his third touchdown pass of the game, maybe even his fourth. And I jokingly tweeted that, you know, Jack Cohn has now become the greatest lacrosse turned college football player in the history of American sport. You know, step aside Jim Brown and Chris Hogan as a joke, you know. And all of a sudden somebody slid into my DMs saying, like, whoa, I know you're kidding, but you've gone a little too far with the Jim Brown, you know, talk, the slander. And that person who had never contacted me before in any way, shape, or form was Mike Tirico. And
I thought you were going to say Nick Osello, but go on.
Mike Tirico, slide into my DMs. I'm like, I didn't even know he was following me. I don't know who told him about this. So of course, you know, I said, well, hey, listen, I saw the Dirty Dozen. Jim Brown is a legend. You know, until Jack Cohn appears in a movie with Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine, you know, he's not even close.
It's unlikely.
If Florida State won, there would have been a movie on Mackenzie Milton's comeback, and he could have played a starring role.
Hey, he might be in that movie. So it was very funny. And so we had a nice, you know, friendly chat. But I just thought it's amazing. This is what makes, you know, college football great. I don't think Mike Tirico would have gotten into my DMs for anything I would have said during the Olympics, right? He wouldn't have been like, no, you know, I don't think, I'm trying to remember his name, Warholm, the Norwegian 400, you know, meter hurdler. I don't think Carsten Warholm is the greatest 400 meter hurdler. That would not have gotten Mike Tirico into my DMs. But we have just mentioned Norwegian intermediate hurdlers on the Shamrock, which I imagine is a first.
That's definitely a first. And Ernest Borgnine, he has not come up either.
If you criticize Peacock, maybe that will get you another DM.
That might be it.
Does bring me to my next question. And again, yes. I'm sure you'll see the highlights because you're not going to be watching it, but what are your expectations for Drew Brees in his broadcasting debut?
Wow, that's a great question. I think he'll do very well. Every time I've ever seen him talk, he's obviously, very intelligent, very thoughtful, insightful. It's his first, you know, they're throwing him in the deep end in the sense of, not that it's Toledo, that's or Peacock, but I mean, this is where he's beginning basically his broadcast career on national television, on network, you know, on TV, big games. So there's probably going to be a few rough edges, but there are some guys like Peyton Manning would be fine in his first start. Drew Brees to a certain degree. I think Aaron Rodgers would be great. You know, I look at baseball and I listen to John Smoltz and I just think, I'm sure people who hung around John Smoltz his whole career knew he'd be great at this, especially writers who covered the Braves. I imagine writers who cover the Saints are going to tell you that Drew Brees is going to do a great job. Don't you think?
Yeah, I feel like I have high expectations for this one. It's a matter of doing your homework, right? Like, is the NBC broadcast sort of treated as getting reps for the NFL, or is it sort of its own thing, right? Like, because I think it can be both, and it needs to be both for it to go really well. But I could see it also being like, let's have you do Notre Dame, so we're preparing you to sort of be a Tony Romo type down the road for us. On air in games.
That's my,
that's,
I mean,
possible.
Don't expect Romo. Like, I think he'll be good, but I think Romo is so freaking good and so one of a kind. And we saw Monday Night Football try to replicate that. and it didn't work. And, you know, it's like every other business. Someone tries something new, it works, and everyone else wants to try it. I think he'll be good. I don't know if I want to, like, sit back and wait for him to be the next Romo, because I just don't know if that's possible for anyone.
I was actually intrigued, and I was working for your audience. Now, I was working for NBC at the Olympics this summer when all the Maria Taylor stuff was going down. So I was kind of curious. It's like, well, we bought this shiny new toy. How are we going to deploy it? And, you know, the scuttlebutt was like, well, they're not going to put her on Notre Dame football because she has to do Sunday Night Football. Like that's where she's more valuable. But it is interesting to me because Maria Taylor did a great job on College Game Day, but she won't be involved with Notre Dame football as far as I know. Even though she would do a wonderful job there, but you know, I'm curious to see how she herself evolves and feels about this. Cause she's a great sideline reporter. So she went from being the number one sideline reporter on ABC's number one game to not being a sideline reporter, at least for right now, for college.
I thought the same with Heather Cox when NBC hired her. I thought she'd be doing, cause she was ABC's number one at the time too. And she never did Notre Dame.
No, she didn't. So that'll be, and I feel bad for Maria Taylor because now Georgia's finally good. Like that's her alma mater.
They're always good, John.
Now they're really good. So I found it funny.
What? Tell me more about this ASU class. What's Professor Walters like?
Oh my gosh, you have to ask. Well, don't ask me, but I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy it. I teach three courses this semester, and I try to get Pete Sampson, you know, come and at least kill one of those days with his insights and expertise per semester. And then Bruce Feldman comes in and lets everybody know, you know, you can do this too. So anyway, it's fun. I try to mix in sports, but history. And I have a few crackpot theories that I'm sure Pete's going like, well, wow, that's surprising.
Is there another that, kind of theory I would ask you?
Well, that I have? No. Yeah. So I try to mess with their minds a little bit to think about sports beyond the bubble that they've grown up in watching sports. Why, you know, one of the things I tell to them about is, why do you think 105,000 people come in to watch a football game even after their team's been eliminated from playoff contention? You know, you could get, so I try to appeal to their demo. I said, like, you get Kanye West to sell out a stadium that big once or twice, but you couldn't get it probably five times a year or six times a year in the same city. Like, what makes sport, particularly football, a different level of entertainment? And why are we so obsessed with it as a culture? So I try to get them to think about stuff like that. I
would definitely take this class, John.
Well, so I recently showed them, and Matt, I don't know if you've seen it or Pete, like the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. And early in the film, and anybody listening can YouTube it, there's a scene where two little tribes of chimps are fighting over a little pool of water, basically because it's survival, right? But one tribe of chimps has learned to use bones as a tool and the other has not. So that tribe, the top guy beats the other top guy to death and it's survive and advance, right? And I say, you know, my students laugh and stuff. And then I say, but we've evolved so far. And the next thing I show is a fan fight in the stands of a Chargers-Rams preseason game. And it looks remarkably similar, except for the bone. You know, so the point is, like, we've come nowhere as a society, as a species, we've come nowhere. And the kicker on this is at least the chimps were fighting over something that mattered. Like, they were fighting over water to survive. What are the Rams and Chargers fans fighting over?
In the preseason.
In the preseason. Thank you.
So this sounds a lot more like a sociology or history class.
It is a little bit like a sociology and history class, Matt. It is. So I could go on, but I don't want to bore your audience, but it's stuff like that.
Good luck transitioning to that one, Peter.
Yeah, I know. I'm having a hard time thinking of a follow-up question on this. But if this podcast is running long, we have a Brian Kelly press conference coming up. What do you think of Notre Dame after watching Sunday night? Like, and I ask that in the sense of so much of like the Notre Dame coverage, and it was refreshing not to cover Notre Dame this way on Sunday, but I'm going to transition back into it, is like, is Notre Dame getting any closer to Alabama? Is it getting any closer to Ohio State? Is it getting any closer to Clemson / Georgia? Do you watch Notre Dame through that prism still, or are you, have you sort of figured out a way to enjoy it without thinking about winning a national championship?
I'll tell you, my best friend from Notre Dame always says, he's like, I just root us to finish fifth in the standings every year. He wants us to be fifth when the playoff selection committee things come out. And I get it.
He's going to love the 12-teamer, by the way, where they get a home game out of that. But go on.
Exactly. You get a home game out of that. I just think the world has changed so much. It's to be where Alabama and Ohio State and soon maybe Texas A&M are is so difficult. Not because the kids aren't like trying their best, like the resources allocated to football in those areas are ridiculous. Like I looked at Notre Dame the other night, again, what we always talked about, like within the athletes Notre Dame has, they play about as well as can possibly be expected. And then you get a Kyle Hamilton who makes the plays that you guys saw that Pete highlighted on Twitter, that one play, which is Quentin Nelson-esque. Like the difference between Alabama and Notre Dame is they've got 8 to 12 Kyle Hamiltons, maybe more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Kyle Hamilton is a special talent. And even Kevin Austin, what he showed, or Michael Mayer, like to be where Alabama is, you've got to have 10 to 15 guys like that on your squad. You've got guys like that sitting the bench at Alabama. And you know, Eric Parsegian used to have teams like that relative to other teams. It's hard. It's really hard to get that many guys of that talent. And talent matters. Like, you know, coaching matters, but talent matters. Like having Michael Mayer on your team makes third down a lot easier, as you illustrated on one of your tweets, I think this morning, about the third and shorts passing the ball. So I look at it through the prism of, given who they have, how well are they playing? And for this season, to me, that comes down to, like, if I'm looking at one position group, I'm looking at linebackers. They've just lost two of the important linebackers. Prince Colley is on the two deep now, right?
He is.
He's a true freshman who's highly rated. You know, the other night, and did you guys notice this too? Like, watching on television, I kept seeing number 27. Kept seeing number 27, which is J.D. Bertrand,
mm-hmm.
who has made a remarkable step up in just, you know, in his time there. Like, he was a key player now on that defense. He's, I don't know where you'd rank him in terms of importance on that defense, but I felt like he was in the middle of so many plays watching Sunday night, and I didn't see him at all last year, basically.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're dead on. He was not involved. I think he played about 30 snaps all year and played 70 against Florida State. So it's just a completely different set of circumstances for him. And like, as you mentioned, his importance has gone up because they don't have anybody else. I mean, they're down. Yeah. It's basically him at that position now. So it's, you know, when you look at what Alabama is doing, I think, you know, they lost a dynamic edge rusher over the weekend after Miami game, but it's,
right,
kind of no great shakes there. Like, just roll out the next guy off the factory line. And like, Notre Dame is sort of a little bit closer to like a bare bones situation, like after 1 week at that position.
Did you see, I know you guys were at the game, but I don't know if you watched it on TV afterward to watch the replay. Did you see what the Aflac trivia question was?
I did see that. Yeah.
Yes.
Wasn't that surprising?
It's, you know, I had looked it up a while back. I think it was maybe around the time Jalen Smith was going to go top 10 until he got hurt. So I knew the answer, but it is the fact that, you know, the last top 10 pick from Notre Dame on defense was Bryant Young after the 93 season.
Yeah, 93 season.
Is pretty wild. It's pretty wild that Notre Dame hasn't had anybody sniff it.
I was home for that game. I watched that too. And I remember that stat coming up when Ronnie Stanley was drafted in the top 10 in 2016, I think,
mm-hmm.
which was crazy because they've had multiple since then, particularly on the offensive line. But one of those things you just don't really think about till it smacks you in the face like that on national TV.
Wow. Hey, I want to point out one play from the game that has gotten a little attention, but I don't think enough. Mackenzie Milton's shovel pass.
Mm.
If you watch that play, there's two Notre Dame defenders who know it's coming. they are ready for it. Like, it's a great athletic play by Mackenzie Milton. JD Bertrand and one lineman sort of saw what was happening if you watch the play. And so, like, you know, so many times, oh, the defense should have been ready for that or blah, blah, blah. They were sort of ready for it. He just made a better play. And so that leads to my question is, where was Mike Norvell in August? Like, was he watching Florida State's practices? How obvious was it who the better intuitive quarterback was?
I mean, Travis, by all accounts, though, was winning throughout August, and they just waited to announce it. And they have Orr again on the depth chart for week two. Like, I don't disagree with anything you said. I do wonder if there was some magic in the moment and the momentum where you catch a really good team off guard defensively that let their guard down, and it's a once in a lifetime moment you'll never be able to recreate. Like, we all know what Mackenzie Milton is capable of healthy. We saw it 3 years ago, but, you know, what's he going to be like in the third quarter against Jacksonville State this weekend when it's, you know, a close game?
I know we're not all going to be following Florida State as closely the rest of the year, but I'm going to say, based on all the football we watch in our lives, like, this guy is just intuitively a better quarterback. And I think Travis Jordan looks like is more athletic, and Mackenzie Milton isn't even 6 feet tall, but he just makes plays. He just made plays. And if I'm wrong, well, hopefully we'll revisit this at some point, but I just, that blew my mind. And I know the momentum and the magic of the moment, but he just made plays. And I don't know, you know, that's, there's more than just coaching in there. He's just, it shocked me, like, watching that, like, how Mike Norvell had him on the bench until, 9 minutes left in the game.
I would argue his best play of the night, in keeping with the theme you were just talking about, intuitiveness, the last play of regulation. I mean, wild snap. They're about to be out of field goal range. Somehow this guy who almost had his leg amputated 3 years ago has the presence of mind to pick up the football and throw it away and keep them in field goal range. Like, that play should have decided the game. Yeah,
right, and pass the line of scrimmage. Anyway, but, you know, we haven't given enough time to Toledo in this podcast.
Do you have a hot take on Toledo?
I've got one hot take on Toledo. Are you ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Because, you know, we're talking from Phoenix, and my son's lost, you know, the championship. Toledo's two offensive stars are Kevin Johnson, a former Phoenix Suns guard, and Jawan Carter, which is a lot like Javon Carter, who's a current Suns guard. So I think, Matt or Pete, that needs to be in the lead of your story.
Pete can take that one.
Yeah, I appreciate the tip, because I may have a hard time figuring out something interesting to write off this game on Saturday, especially following up on the Florida State game. Just not going to feel the same.
It won't have the same magic to it. That's okay. You got a couple weeks. I won't look forward. I don't want to make that mistake. So I'm not even going to go there.
Their D-line coach is Larry Black. He was a GA when Notre Dame made the playoff in 2018. I think that's probably the only connection between these players.
Jonathan Jones, graduate transfer linebacker, is
didn't know he was there.
I believe still on that roster as a sixth-year senior.
Well, you guys know, like, there are plenty of Toledo area students at Notre Dame.
Deshaun Kizer.
Yes. All right, Deshaun Kizer. Like, there's some schools in that area that are good feeder schools for Notre Dame. So I think there'll be some good connections, at least that way, among students in the stands paying attention.
The stands is kind of an interesting thing, because barring something miraculous, it's not going to sell out. It may not even be close. I don't know if we're sort of issuing in a new era of Notre Dame fandom, or just there's too many variables in the COVID world to really draw any conclusions off of it.
Have they considered contacting Trev Alberts about this? He's really good. And making those non-sellouts disappear.
Yeah, I think Notre Dame has exhausted its budget for calling in alums to buy tickets for the game. And they're just like, you know what? We're just going to save this money. And watch those seats sit up.
People were saving up for Peacock Plus. Simple as that.
Peacock Plus. You guys reach out to me after the podcast. I actually have a couple of classmates of mine from Notre Dame who are insanely wealthy who we can reach out to if we really need it. It's not me, obviously, but they've got some names on buildings there. Kids I just was sitting in South Dining Hall with not all that long ago. So you reach out to me, I'll reach out to them. We can make this happen.
Right. I thought you were going to say they were going to have a watch party because they didn't want to pay individually to watch this game on streaming.
They're not multimillionaires because they're stupid, Matt. Like
they stay rich by not spending their money on stuff they don't need.
There you go.
All right. Well, John, we appreciate you taking some time out for your morning in Arizona to join us on the Shamrock. We have not touched enough of Ernest Borgnine commentary or Jim Brown, the lacrosse player, or we don't have Seinfeld references on the show either. So thank you for filling all three of those holes.
And Blondie's.
Yeah, I am going to do my best to get Ernest Borgnine at one reference every time. If I ever appear back on the Shamrock, we're going to have another Ernest Borgnine. It could be Marty. I don't know. It's going to be something. But
well, next time you go on the Audible with Bruce and Stu, like I will be listening for your Ernest Borgnine reference.
I'll make it an adjective. I'll say he was positively Borgnine-esque in the way he performed. Something to that effect.
I love it. Well, John, thanks again for taking some time to join the Shamrock. And we will definitely have you back for future 1950s and 60s cinema references down the road.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.